time for a which is the number one chocolate
drink. Two pizzas for the price of one.
A taste so wonderful.
That's a spicy meat.
I don't think we should be fighting spin with more misinformation and lack of transparency. What we should be fighting spin with is the real story.
Thanks for joining us for The Secret Ingredient, a podcast produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas, that takes you into the depths of food history and production. We won't tell you what to eat, but we can tell you why you're eating it. For KUT, I'm Rebecca McEnroy.
And I'm Tom Philpott, food and agriculture writer for Mother Jones Magazine.
I'm Raj Patel from the Lyndon Baines Johnson School of Public Affairs. Today's secret ingredient is spin. To discuss spin, we have award-winning founder of the Small Planet Institute and the Small Planet Fund, Anna LaPay. Anna is the author or co-author of three major books, all of which you need to read. Diet for a Small Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork, and What You Can Do About It. Spin is something that's in everything. And yeah, I mean, I thought the conceit today maybe would be to start with thinking about spun sugar. You've written at length about how it is that a variety of industries that are pushing sugar are spinning their use of sugar. And I wonder maybe whether that's where we could start. Can you talk to us a little bit about the spin that's on sugar?
Sure. And as you say, when we talk about spin, it's sort of an equal opportunity employer. I mean, there isn't a single aspect of what we eat that is not touched by industry spin. And I know you guys and a lot of your listeners, you know, are very critical about thinking about where your food comes from and sort of trying to understand that part of the story. And I guess my intervention here is to say that we should also be thinking about where the story of our food comes from. And as you said, sugar is perhaps one of the most spun ingredients. There's been incredible reporting in the past few years. Mother Jones, a little hat tip to you, Tom. Mother Jones has done some great breaking investigative work showing how the sugar industry, the trade association pushing sugar into not just sugary drinks, but processed foods, has been at work for decades to shape the story of sugar and really shift the blame for chronic illnesses like heart disease, for instance, away from sugar and over to fat, by actually employing research scientists to tell that story of sugar. And what we've seen over decades is sort of an elevation of fat as the bad guy and a dismissal of sugar as being so linked to chronic illnesses that we care about. And so what I was excited to see just in the past few years is this real breakthrough in reporting that showed that industry spin that was happening around sugar, showed how much the industry was shaping the story of sugar, and I hope is really part of what can arm advocates across the country to speak up for common sense policy that would start reducing the amount of sugar that we're consuming.
And Anna, even now, after all that reporting, the industry is still spinning, right? I mean, aren't the soft drink companies still employing the same old tactics?
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about it. A company like Coca-Cola spends $3.5 billion, that's with a B, $3.5 billion on marketing its products every year. And most of what it sells us is sugary drinks. And you're absolutely right. I mean, despite what we now know about this long history of spin, you see companies like Coca-Cola doing something just as recently as in 2014. The corporation invested in a new nonprofit organization based out of the University of Colorado called the Global Energy Balance Network. And the mission of this organization was to spin the story of soda and sugary drinks and say the problem with kids today, the problem with all of us, and isn't that we're eating too much sugar or drinking too much sugar. It's that we're not exercising enough. We need to exert more energy. And thanks to good investigative reporting, it came out, it was revealed that actually that Global Energy Balance Network was being funded by Coca-Cola to tell that story. And thankfully, actually, Coca-Cola pulled out its funding. That initiative dissolved. But of course, there's a lot more like them out there. And that organization, to me, is a classic example of what folks looking at the story of spin like to call front groups. So these are organizations that are on the surface and sort of public facing. They seem like they're serving the public interest and they're for the social benefit of all of us, when really they're funded by corporations and really serving the interests of those corporations. So the Global Energy Balance Network is just one of literally dozens and dozens of dozens of these kinds of front groups out there.
You know, Anna, it's interesting because when you're talking about this, it's like I kind of take for granted the fact that advertising agencies and marketing companies are going to spin things, you know, and it's like, well, that's their job. That's what they're going to do. But what's interesting about your work is that you're talking about a story that's constructed even outside of that, about how we understand food and how we understand what food is good for us and bad for us. And it tries to kind of complicate these competing mythologies that aren't only transported through the advertising agencies and the marketing campaigns. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Look, of course, a company is going to advertise its product. But what I like to kind of picture in my mind's eye is this kind of spectrum of spin that goes from the most obvious, which is, you know, advertising and marketing. And of course, that's the job of companies that are producing products to sell their stuff to us and share with us what's good about those products and why we should want them. What I'm talking about is on the rest of the spectrum, which I see as kind of increasingly stealth and increasingly about subterfuge and really shaping and sort of massaging the truth. And so a front group, for instance, that to me isn't advertising. That is actually misinformation and propaganda. In fact, the very first front group that at least I'm aware of was created by the father of the PR industry as we know it today, Edward Bernays, at the turn of the last century. And he created something called the Celiac Institute, and he employed doctors and public health officials and others with great stature in the community to tout the incredible benefits of consuming bananas for celiac sufferers. Guess who was funding the Celiac Institute?
Big Banana?
And if you want to take a guess. Big Banana. That's right. The United Fruit Company, is the biggest producer and importer of bananas, was funding the Celiac Institute. So a brilliant PR move, and it's a tactic that we've seen, you know, really ever since. So that's kind of what I'm talking about, Rebecca. This isn't about direct advertising or marketing that is very transparent to us as consumers. We know we're being marketed to when we look at a label or we see a billboard. What I'm talking about is this stealth marketing that I think is really destructive to the public conversation about what we should be eating and how we should be producing our food.
And on that same tip, kind of how are you combating that? Because it is such a stealth mission. And I mean, I see things happening like that you think are kind of banal when people talk about, oh, organic food's actually not that good for you. You know, I read something somewhere that they're not that good, or they're not this, or they're not that, you know. But it's like, this is really word of mouth. People reading something that they come across on the internet, and then all of the sudden sharing it. And in that manner, how do you kind of get into that conversation?
Well, this is why it's so challenging, because you're exactly right. These are the kinds of messages and sort of shaping of a narrative that happens in so many different ways. It happens online, on social media, on Facebook, with the headlines in mainstream media, with industry-funded think tanks that are putting out research that benefits industry and that sort of tells the industry's side of the story. And how do we combat that? It's really tricky, in part because so much money is going into this kind of narrative formation, if you want to call it that. Colleagues of mine and I looked into just the amount of money going into about a dozen of these industry-funded front groups from 2009 to 2013. And we were able to calculate from their public records, because these are all nonprofits, so they're filing their tax 990s with the IRS, we were able to estimate that about $125 million was being spent over those years just for those front groups. We're not even talking about trade association misinformation campaigns. So how do you combat it? First, acknowledge that you're up against a huge amount of funding. And secondly, this is at least my strategy, is try to expose the spin. I feel like one of the best ways to combat it is to help reveal this stealth marketing and messaging that happens, that I see that as a way to sort of inoculate all of us to those messages. But it's, you know, it's really tricky. I mean, I think about just one of the best examples of how pernicious this kind of messaging is, I think, is a website that was created for the trade group promoting GMOs or genetically engineered seeds. It was called, it's still out there, GMOAnswers.org. Mm. It was created by Ketchum, which is one of the largest PR firms in the world, again, hired by the trade group to promote GMOs. And the conceit of the site is, come here, we will offer you answers about GMOs. And they brought in, quote unquote, experts to answer people's questions. But those experts, many of them have direct ties to biotech corporations, including I saw some answers written by people in the communications department of Monsanto. But your average everyday person wouldn't realize who was behind those messages. And then what Ketchum did is not only create this website, but layer onto it a whole social media strategy where they had staff that were actually actively responding to tweets that they saw in the Twittersphere that were critical of GMOs or, you know, I don't know, Tom, maybe even retweeting one of your articles from Mother Jones. Anytime there was negative tweets about GMOs, they had people going in and engaging with those people on Twitter saying, hey, have you seen GMO Answers? Do you want to take a look at what this website has to say about this issue? And Ketchum bragged in its report about this website, it bragged that it was able to reduce the negative commentary about GMOs on Twitter by 80% over the period that they were tracking this. So this is very pernicious and very pervasive. And I think, again, one of the ways to do it is to kind of increase all of our spidey senses to ask questions about who's putting out information that we're reading, who's it funded by, what connections do the authors have to industry, if any.
And Anna, I think that that example of GMOs brings up a major point here, and that is that sometimes the spin is really silly. You have an industry telling you, or you have, you know, some allegedly disinterested group telling you to eat bananas for a disease that is caused by wheat, right? So that's obviously silly, and it's not going to work. But they also, in, you know, these more in more recent examples like GMOs, have managed to be able to change public conversations. And I think we've talked before about, it was before these revelations about Ketchum was when we last talked about this, but there was a certain point around 2012, 2013, maybe around when California was considering a GMO labeling proposition, around that time, there was this change in conversation in national media and outlets like the New York Times, where suddenly anyone who questioned GMOs was, you know, sort of declared anti-science, and sort of kind of, you know, sort of insane. And I think both of us and maybe even Raj got tarred with that. And I wonder if you can talk through that and what connection did these spin groups have with that change in conversation?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think it can really be tied back to a real deployment of resources and dollars to these kinds of spin efforts. And so I remember seeing it was in about 2010, there was a series of articles in some industry magazines about agribusiness and the food industry and about concerns that companies were having about essentially this growing public concern about everything from antibiotics used in livestock production to GMOs, to the concerns about the health impacts of sugary drinks and processed foods. And what these articles and these trade publications were saying is that the industries at the heart of essentially the status quo and industrial agriculture were really starting to strategize about how to develop some communications responses. And out of that came more front groups, including an organization called the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, which again sounds like represents all U.S. farmers and ranchers. But actually, if you look at who's behind it, it is the biggest agrochemical companies like Dow, and it's the biggest pharmaceutical companies that are really at the center of this public health crisis around antibiotic use in livestock, companies like Elanco, and so on. And what essentially U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance was created to do was to, as they put it, reverse consumers' negative perceptions about food and agriculture. And that organization alone has had a budget of about $10 million a year ever since. And I think has been part of trying to really shift that conversation. They do it with all kinds of different strategies, including training farmers to be messengers of this status quo industrial ag message. They have a program with a great acronym called EASE, which I thought was interesting that it stood for Engage, Acknowledge, Share, and Earn Trust. And they said in their annual reports that the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance trained more than 8,000 farmers in this EASE training. And then what you see is those farmers writing op-eds in newspapers and getting their voices out there, not tied to a trade group that's being funded by, say, Elanco, which is this pharmaceutical company promoting antibiotics, but written by and seeming like it's speaking for a farmer, writing op-eds, for instance, saying, no, we don't overuse antibiotics in livestock production. That's a myth that you're hearing from, you know, from foodies on the coasts. So I definitely feel like there's been, and this is what I've been really trying to track since 2010, this real surge in spending on spin. You mentioned GMO labeling. The industry spent about $103 million to fight GMO labeling efforts everywhere they emerge. So we're talking about, again, a huge amount of money in a really short amount of time.
But that does beg the question, what's the average person to do when surrounded by a range of conflicting information? You've got some scientists, people in white coats saying that fat is bad, and then other people in white coats saying sugar is bad. And at some level, you lose trust in science altogether, or you lose trust in experts. And one of the inoculants to that, presumably, is a decent scientific training. But not everyone can get that.
Absolutely.
I mean, in a sense, this ends up devolving into a sort of blaming the individual who is being buffeted by billions of PR dollars. What's an average person to do?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, Raj. I mean, is exactly what you're saying. The average person can only do so much, and we can only kind of educate ourselves so much. And this is where I feel like the role of advocates and our elected officials who are supposed to be working for the public good really have a huge role to play, because the average person can only do so much. We need to rely on our trusted public institutions to do their part. So what I mean by that is we need to have certain level of expectation of our media institutions to help us parse information. So we should call on all of our media institutions not to, for instance, quote blindly from a front group, but to say, you know, yes, you might quote for them, but then say this organization is funded by X, Y, and Z company, to have a practice, an editorial practice that helps the reader understand how that message has been shaped and who's behind it. That's on our media institutions to do. And that's what we should be expecting every single media outlet to do. Similarly, public institutions like universities should also be held to a really high standard and shouldn't be places that are influenced by corporate dollars. And the same is true for our private universities. So I think, you know, there's limitations to what we can do as individuals, except that I think we have a responsibility to put pressure on those institutions. Just to give you one example, I remember when there was marketing effort by Monsanto to promote its artificial growth hormone. So this was in the 2000s. There was concern by a number of public health advocates and animal welfare advocates that this artificial growth hormone that Monsanto was pushing for dairy farmers was really harmful to animal welfare, not good for public health, not good for the economics of dairy. And there was big pushback. The artificial growth hormone, the brand name was Posilac. It was also known as RBGH. There was this big, big pushback against RBGH. So what did Monsanto do? One of the things it did was create a front group. It was called American Farmers for the Advancement and Conservation of Technology. And it, AFACT, and the website, it's afact.org. And so the message of this seemingly farmer-led organization was they want artificial growth hormone and they should have the right to choose it, and the activists don't know what they're talking about. And I remember at the time media articles about this organization would quote it as if it was a farmer-led group and not mention that actually it was the outgrowth of the brainchild of this PR company that was working for Monsanto. So that was a great example of, you know, you and I wouldn't have known without doing some of our own digging and spending our own time to do that, what the backstory of that group was. But every single media outlet, if you're going to quote the American Farmers for the Advancement and Conservation of Technology promoting growth hormone, you've got to say it's an organization funded by the company that's profiting from this growth hormone.
You know, I'm wondering about the global comparisons you're seeing to this type of system. And I say that because in the U.S., like, the medical industry is so fraught that we have become kind of disconnected to our own, from our own bodies, knowing what's good, knowing what to trust, trying to figure out and navigate the healthcare system. And the same is true for the food system. And I'm wondering where you see people just kind of saying, you know what, this food doesn't taste good. This food doesn't make me feel good. And why are people not kind of trusting that or getting back to that in order to combat these larger scale attacks on the food that they're eating? And I'm wondering if that's different across the globe.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's such a good point, Rebecca. And actually, we are seeing this huge upswing in people eating more what industry analysts of the supermarkets call pure food. So eating more fruits and vegetables, saying that they want to buy more organic, whether they have access to it or not is another question. But I certainly see this as a trend that is not a fad, but a trend that is here to stay. And when you read the analyst reports from those that are covering the supermarket industry, you hear this loud and clear. They are saying that the supermarket chains and the big box stores that are not positioned to take advantage of people's interest in more fruits and vegetables, you know, are seeing their profits flat or negative. Now, still, I think it's like last time I checked, only 16% of kids in this country are eating the recommended fruits and vegetables. We still have a long way to go. But my point is that I think we are seeing a turning of the tide. And I certainly anecdotally know from talking to people all across the country that when you start trusting your gut, literally, but, you know, as you said, Rebecca, you know, really trusting what tastes good and eating real food and feeling how healthy that makes you, if you can have access to it, and if you can afford it, which are big, big question marks for a lot of people. But if you can embrace that diet and you start eating that kind of food, I'm hearing people really have a change of consciousness around all these bigger questions around food. And I'm certainly not hearing people wanting to go back to the way they were eating before. So I think there is a lot of power in that. But I feel like that's, you know, that's kind of on one side of the coin. And on the other side of the coin, we have to fight for and demand more transparency and information about the food we eat and really expose propaganda when it's happening.
And one of the ways that the alternative food movement has grown in the United States over the past 25 or so years is people hear about things like chemicals and pesticides and growth hormones in food. And they think about their kids and they think about, well, these sort of small, vulnerable bodies, I don't want to be burdening them with these chemicals. And I think that's been a big driver, a lot of research shows, for people going organic. And as you said, you know, even after all the spin, sales of organic foods continue to go up about 10% a year in the United States. But as you've documented, the industry is taking the same impulse, this sort of impulse that people have to feed their kids the best food possible, and twisting it to their own purposes through the rise of these mommy blogs. And I'm wondering if you can talk us through that whole phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is again another tactic that we're seeing from the industry to reach out to influencers, mommy bloggers being one of them, and trying to enlist them to essentially share the industry message. And so we've seen invitations to mommy bloggers from Monsanto to come spend a day, learn about GMOs from our perspective. We've seen examples of bloggers being enlisted to write favorable posts about certain products or about certain practices. For instance, you know, chemical agriculture is a practice, not exactly a product. We've also seen one of the things I am really been particularly disturbed by is the vocal, very harsh bloggers on the islands of Hawaii that have been fighting against and speaking up against the activists in Hawaii that are concerned about those islands being essentially ground zero for testing of GMOs and pesticides. And it turns out that a lot of those bloggers who have been the most vicious in their attack of activists there are connected to the Cornell Alliance for Science, which is an organization that was started in 2014 that's based at Cornell University, funded, as far as I know, entirely or almost entirely by the Gates Foundation, initially with about a $5.6 million grant to the mission being to depolarize the charged debate about GMOs. But most of what they have done is doing things like training bloggers or having immersive workshops for journalists to really promote the benefits of GMOs. And in the case of these bloggers in Hawaii, really, these bloggers have been really trying to tear down the advocates who are trying to protect the islands from GMO testing and spraying of pesticides.
Just to think about these tactics a little bit, I mean, there is a lot of sophistication in them. Though, I mean, in a sense, we've seen this with the tobacco industry, where the tobacco industry will fund, a study that proves very little and will use science to stall in one way or another. But some of your work points us to really one of the bleeding edges of this kind of spin around food, and it's not really with mommy bloggers so much as, or mummy bloggers as we really ought to call them, but with children. And I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about the tactics that the food industry is using to enlist children to be advocates for food in one way or another to their parents.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so we know that that if brands get people early, get kids, you know, get kids excited about their products early on, they really become lifelong consumers of those products, of those foods. And we also know that children very much influence the buying patterns of their parents. And so it was no surprise to me, although it was really disturbing, but no surprise to me to see all of the ways the food industry really is targeting the youngest of our children. And they're doing things not just advertising, again, on that spectrum, Rebecca, of, you know, obviously there's the advertising piece, but they're doing things like getting into our children's schools. I remember getting an email from a friend in Kentucky who whose elementary school daughter came home one day and told her that Ronald McDonald had been at school that day. And this is a colleague who's been really active fighting against fast food. And she said her daughter came home and said that Ronald McDonald had been there. And turns out he had been there as part of a series of free public school assemblies that McDonald's offers. And the particular one, I think, was Ronald McDonald in the Community. And it was all about community service. But it was, talk about a captured audience. You know, their kids had to go to this assembly. And there they were essentially being advertised to by McDonald's. You know, there's so many examples of this. And again, to me, the message is that there should be sanctuary places that are protected from marketing of all stripes, and one of those places is the public school.
And yet the public school becomes a venue for this kind of thing, in part because of the contracts that public schools have to write with food service agencies, and you know, the idea of teachers being paid so very little that they need to supplement their income by volunteering for to feed their kids McDonald's at I can't remember the name of this night where
So
I just heard about that. What was that called?
It's called McTeacher's Night. So this, you're exactly right, Raj, that of course they're exploiting the the fact that we under-resource our public schools in this country. But I would also argue that they are exploiting the idea of that, but what they're offering in return isn't vast amounts of actual charity. It's more pseudo-charity. So, for example, this McTeacher's Night, Trom, you just wrote about it. I've been following this for years. So the concept is your school, the teachers, the principals, any staff, spend an evening at your local McDonald's flipping burgers, serving the community and the kids and the parents from the school. You're encouraged to go to McDonald's and eat that night, and that local franchisee will return back to the school some of the profits made that evening. It turns out colleagues of mine at Corporate Accountability International actually crunched the numbers on this, and it turns out that the average McTeacher's Night only earns about a dollar or less per kid that attends it. You're not talking about a huge amount of money, but talk about brand benefit for McDonald's, that they have this incredible positive community event at a McDonald's where you see your teachers behind the counter. So, you know, that's, I think, perhaps the best example of exploiting the need for schools to be raising money, not giving much back to it. And what I've been encouraged by is actually teachers' unions across the country are starting to speak up against McTeachers' Nights and say, you know, you're taking advantage of our teachers for a private company. It's not appropriate. It's not okay. But that, again, is just one example. Another example that blew my mind when I crunched the numbers on it was a program that Coca-Cola runs called My Coke Rewards. And essentially the concept is you buy a Coke product and you can collect points for every product you buy, and then you can redeem those points for prizes. And so obviously you're being encouraged, incentivized to buy more Coke products. And My Coke Rewards has a whole dedicated section of its online interface and its marketing materials directed to PTAs to encourage parent teachers associations to develop My Coke Reward programs for those schools, to get kids and parents to turn their points in for their schools. And we crunched the numbers, and it turned out to be something like, to get one of the prizes was like an activity kit where you got a jump rope and a ball and some whistles and some cones and a few other things. You would have to, as a school, purchase something like 55,000 Coca-Cola products wow. to get, you know, this basket of activity products. So, I mean, it was just ridiculous on its face. Just if you're going to buy some basketballs, just buy the basketballs. Don't mediate it through Coca-Cola. But again, it's a great example of this company and of taking advantage of schools trying to figure out how to fundraise and do it in a way that ultimately benefits the companies.
You know, Anna, I mean, one thing I was wondering if you might be able to comment on, I don't want to get too far afield, but it's the ways in which these types of tactics are also instilling and reinforcing these types of gender norms or community norms through like the foods that you are consuming together and all of these other types of kind of ideological ideas about how we're interacting with food and each other. What do you see there, and how do you see that interacting?
I mean, I guess, you know, I don't know if this is kind of where you were going with the question, but what comes up for me as you're asking that question is this other element, which we haven't really touched on, about what this spin is, I see it, what it's really doing to us as a culture, as a society. And that's really this cultural infiltration piece where a lot of these brands are really using some of our biggest cultural icons in the arts, in sports, in politics, to really capture our minds and to make us have this kind of positive association with their products. You can think about it with the use of Beyonce and Pepsi, for instance. I think the deal she signed with Pepsi was $40 or $50 million. And I am a huge Beyonce fan. And I have to say, even me, with all of my spin Spidey sense now, I kind of associate Pepsi with Beyonce, and I really like Beyonce, so that's very confusing. But, you know, one of the things I remember seeing that it was, I think, again, another great example of this is the American Beverage Association, again, that's been really feeling the hit of all of this new evidence about the impact of drinking sugary drinks, especially the rise in diabetes in communities of color. And I can just imagine the war room at the American Beverage Association trying to figure out what are we going to do about this. And one of the things they came up with was a tour that they did with DJs to a number of cities. I think this was last summer. It was called My Mixify. And it was supposed to be this kind of hip music tour. And they went to various parks and cities across the country. And they had local kind of YouTube celebrities that would be there. And there was music and a DJ. And of course, there was a lot of paraphernalia for soda. And I was really struck in all of the Instagram pictures at all of these events. It was largely kids of color. I was also really struck that one of my friends actually went to check it out at the one that was hosted in Philadelphia. And as he's walking through the kind of gate into this park where My Mixify was happening, there was a small sign that essentially was legalese about by walking, you know, by entering in this space, you give the rights for your image to be used but in any form of media. I mean, you guys can imagine the legalese by the beverage industry to essentially take your image and use it in any marketing they're going to do about this My Mixify. And, you know, that to me, this idea that these young people in having this fun time. I mean, frankly, the pictures looked like it was a really fun event. But, you know, did they know that they were essentially being exploited and used to be part of this marketing campaign that was trying to paint sugary drinks as part of a balanced diet? The My Mixify message is, you know, mix it up, drink and also exercise and then no problem. You know, were they aware that they were being used in that way? I don't think so. And so, again, it's this way of how our culture, and sometimes unbeknownst to us, and in other times, you know, without our acquiescence, is being shaped by these messages and these companies.
Mm-hmm. So, Anna, there's a certain sense in which the gig is up on all this in the United States. People are getting wise to it. Soda sales have been falling for 20 years. I mean, there's still a lot of junk food out there, but we've reached a point where it's not growing very fast. And these are publicly traded capitalist enterprises that need to show quarterly profits. So I think they're moving. There's a lot of attention to moving overseas, to moving to places in the global south where economies are growing fast and people are moving up in income. And are we seeing similar spin campaigns also moving in that direction?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I would say, I mean, I wish that the gig was up, Tom. And I think certainly there are certain signs that there's progress, but at the same time, you know, as you know, we're seeing soda sales go down at the same time that we're seeing bottled water go up. And obviously, we want to drink water. Do we want to have the bottled water industry be omnipresent? Not so sure. And
true,
we're seeing this huge spike in energy drinks.
Yes.
Which essentially is soda and without the bubbles. I mean, it's essentially the same amount of sugar, but then also even more caffeine. So I would say, you know, now is not the time to kind of sit back and say, you know, we won this battle. You know, what's next? I think we're very much still in it. But the second thing I would say is you're absolutely right that these industries are moving overseas. I wouldn't say it's necessarily knew that we're seeing that. I think this has been a trend we've seen now for several decades, is this real expansion into emerging markets. And just like big tobacco, I mean, you look at tobacco, I would say, of course, is one of the biggest public health successes of our lifetimes here in the United States. But look at what big tobacco is doing in India and China, and the rates of smoking in much of the global south have yet to experience the public health success that we've had here. And unfortunately, we're seeing similar expansion overseas. But again, this has been going on for a long time. I remember reading many years ago this fabulous book by Benjamin Barber called Jihad vs. McWorld. And he had this quote that has stuck with me ever since I read it, that he quoted from a Coca-Cola annual report, I think from the mid-90s, that was talking about its presence in India. And the annual report said, we have to kill tea culture in India.
Wow.
This idea that if people are drinking their traditional cooling beverages, they're not going to be reaching for a Coke. And, you know, this idea that these industries knew and wanted to and needed to expand both their markets in the U.S. but also overseas is you know, been going on for years. And it's something that, I think is why it's so important that we be looking at how can we work with international advocacy partners? How can we also really put pressure on the World Health Organization to have very clear conflict of interest policies around it? Influence of industry at the World Health Organization level. It's those kinds of things that I think are really going to be important moving forward.
Though, to be fair, I mean, the international partners sometimes look at the United States and shake their heads. I mean, in India, for example, you're absolutely right that, Coke and Pepsi have you know, taken over even the very language of talking about having a cold drink is now being co-opted by Coca-Cola. But you know, there have been some high profile sort of moments where, for example, Amitabh Bachchan, the biggest star in the Bollywood firmament, stepped back from promoting Pepsi when a small girl came up to him and said, "Uncle, why is it that you are endorsing a product that's basically poison?" And you know, he was taken aback and he withdrew his support for this. And meanwhile, other Bollywood stars are quite happy to cash in, though less you know, with less alacrity perhaps. But in India, things like a soda tax are now legislation. In mm-hmm. Brazil, they're mooting things like banning the marketing of everything to children, and they wonder why it is that we're not doing that here. Why aren't we doing that here?
Yeah, no, you're right. Or Mexico, you know, as you know, passed the nationwide soda tax there. I mean, I think that this amount of influence on our body politic of corporate dollars cannot be stressed enough. I mean, that so shapes what policy we have. It so shapes you know, who gets elected and what they do once they're elected. And so, you know, I think there's incredible connection between any issue you work on and the growing movement to get money out of politics. They're so interconnected. You know, I think about the local battles around trying to get a sugary drink tax on the ballot here in the Bay Area and how much money the beverage industry has spent to try to fight those efforts. When Berkeley, California, the city that I live in, when we passed the tax, we did so facing $2.4 million in industry campaigning against the tax and kind of trying to shape the story of what the tax was. So I think it's this incredible infusion of money into politics that's really limited how much progress we've seen. Because when you talk to people, you know, and I get to talk to a lot of people around this country about these issues, I feel like so many more people have shared values around everything from public health to animal welfare to environmental sustainability that we're not seeing reflected in the policies that are in place.
I have one last question. You know, Slavoj Žižek has this argument that, like, you're not going to buy...
Wait, who's Slavoj Žižek?
He's got this great argument that's like...
I love how you just, like, worked that in there. just had this thought.
Well, but my question is, why not combat spin with spin? Because what he's saying, basically, is, like, we don't buy organic products because we actually think they're good. We buy them because they make us feel better about our capitalist institution that we live in, and we feel like we're kind of, like, doing something thing for the greater good when we buy organic products. Are they really doing good? Are they not? Who knows? And so that's his argument. But I'm wondering, like, wouldn't there be power in kind of creating and trying to make these stories on your end, from your end? What do you think?
Well,
why not?
I mean, this is what Real Food Media is trying to do, except the difference I would say is that, you know, to me, spin is defined by misinformation, no transparency about the messenger, and serving private interest. what I am trying to do and what I think we need to do is not fight spin with spin. I don't think we should be fighting spin with more misinformation and lack of transparency. What we should be fighting spin with is the real story, really making sure that the people who are on the front lines of being impacted by this food system have a voice at the table and that that voice is being heard, that we make sure that the researchers that are really working in the public interest are supported at their academic institutions and that their research is heard, that we make sure that the media is holding its sources accountable and making sure that that is there's transparency there. So to me, that's how we fight it. I don't think I want to get into, you know, I don't think I could sleep at night if I was in the misinformation game that Ketchum, for instance, is. But that's exactly why I started Real Food Media. I started it with a series of food myth-busting videos to take on some of the spin. I have done things like partnered with StoryCorps, which I love, an organization that really helps people share their story to bring out the stories of food workers along the food chain. So we're trying all different kinds of ways to elevate this story, but again, not stooping to their level of spin and misinformation.
What can ordinary people do to support what it is that you're up to? How can we get involved?
Well, people can go to Real Food Media at our website. People can do lots of different things. We have lots of ways that we are trying to engage people to think critically about the story of their food. People can check out our film series, realfoodfilms.org, which is an international short films competition where we highlight amazing stories about food, farming, and sustainability. People can join our monthly book club. I'm trying to get people to, I'm highlighting some of my favorite authors who've written about food issues in ways that I think are really compelling. And so people can join our monthly book club. And one of the other things that we're really engaged with is helping tell the story of a powerful new policy called the Good Food Purchasing Policy, which is this idea of having school districts and cities be empowered to look at their food procurement through the lens of environmental sustainability and worker welfare, animal welfare, health and nutrition, and supporting local economies. So our work at Real Food Media is really elevating the story of that policy and how that policy can really, really bring into people's lives, especially kids in schools and other public institutions, exactly the kind of food that we've been talking about today.
Anna LePay is the award-winning founder of the Small Planet Institute and the Small Planet Fund and the author of Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It. You can subscribe to The Secret Ingredient on iTunes or SoundCloud and find out more information on this show and our entire archive at thesecretingredient.org. Join Tom Philpott, Rebecca McEnroy, and me, Raj Patel, for the next episode of The Secret Ingredient, when we'll talk with Barbadian artist and activist Anna Lee Davis about the history of slavery in the Caribbean, how she sees the planet recovering from colonialism, and the importance of remembering and reckoning with racial trauma. The Secret Ingredient next time is Bush Tea. Our engineer is David Alvarez, and thank you to our wonderful intern, Shelby Hicks. From KUT in Austin, Texas, I'm Raj Patel. Thanks for listening.